I want to welcome everyone to the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims. It is the appointed hour at 6 o'clock, and for the record, I want to say that there is a quorum of four present. So welcome to the committee. Our first item on the agenda is to approve the March 26, 2012 minutes. Does someone have a motion?
So moved.
Representative Simon moves to approve the March 26 minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion approved. Thank you. The next item is to go into the claims, and I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Timmons, the subcommittee counsel, to explain. Maybe what I'll say first is to explain why we're here. We're here to address claims that are claims extending relief to individuals where they have no other recourse. And what there's a very considered process to file for a complaint or file a complaint and get it heard. There are also very strict rules about what is addressable and what is not addressable. And so now after that, I will turn it over to Ms. Timmons, where she will begin the process.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, I believe the first claim is a claim against the Department of Human Services, and this is the William Eggert claim. There are representatives here from both parties. Mr. Eggert is represented by his counsel, Kenneth R. White, and the Department of Human Services is represented by counsel Leah Fliegerer, Chad Messagetic, and Carrie Anderson. This is a claim for $40,000, and I believe on your desks you should have some new information that was submitted by Mr. Eggert's attorney. Well, it was dated April 3rd, but we just received it today. And one of the questions I had is whether the claim was solely for wage loss or whether there was also a claim for permanent partial disability. And in the letter, Mr. White explains he is claiming $15,000 of the $40,000 for a 2% denervation of the right triceps muscle. Although, one thing I wanted to point out is that I think under the workers' compensation schedule, 2% of the $75,000 would be $1,500 rather than $15,000. So I believe that $15,000 figure is probably in error, but Mr. White can address that. The Department of Human Services recommends that the entire claim be denied, the department has submitted pretty extensive work history records that show approximately $1,116 in quarterly earnings prior to the alleged injury. Then in the third and fourth quarters of 2010, Mr. Eggert earned only $17. But in the first quarter of 2011, he had average earnings again of about $1,014. The second, third, and fourth quarters of 2011 were low again. But by 2012 and 2013 to date, his earnings have exceeded what was pre-injury. So, essentially, this is based, the claim, personal injury claim, is based on a May 18th, 2010 incident in the vocational shop at the Minnesota, at MSOP at Moose Lake, the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program, where he pulled on some shelving and injured his elbow and his right arm. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you would like to have testimony.
Yes, I think.
Probably the representative from the claimant, Mr. Eggert.
Yes. Mr. White. Please approach the microphone, identify yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
It's getting old. Thank you, Senator and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to appear on behalf of Mr. Eggert. I had a lengthy telephone conversation with Mr. Eggert today regarding the department's response, which is dated April 4th, 2013, and which I received 3 or 4 days later. And what I'd like to do is to go through basically the department's letter of April 4, provide you with his response and some comments on the attachments that the department provided, and then answer any questions that the committee may have. I do it. Should I do it my home address or business address? Initially, the department's response questions the existence of the injury and the nature and extent of the injury.
Excuse me, Mr. White. We're actually trying to locate that April 4th letter right now for the committee.
Mr. Chairman, this is Michelle Timmons, committee counsel. It's about a dozen pages before the end of the claim is the. There's quite a bit of documentation here. But that's about the location where you'll find the Department of Human Services response letter.
You want to comment? Proceed, Mr.
Thank you, Senator. Throughout the report or the letter, the department refers to the alleged injury or the suspected injury or claimed injury. And I'd suggest to you that, in fact, if you look at their own attachments to the letter, there is really little or no question about the injury. The first document, which has a U1 label on it, is Mr. Eggert's initial injury report, taken on May 18th, 2010, the same day as the injury, in which he talks about trying to pull that shelf down and having an immediate burning sensation running up his arm, and that he was having trouble grasping or otherwise holding on to objects with his right arm. Health Services was notified, and Mr. Eggert was sent to Health Services immediately. If you then turn the page to what is in the upper right-hand corner, U8, there's a May 18 entry, and on the next page there's also a May 18 entry, the one at 14:30 and the other at 2:30 p.m., both of which, again, substantiate exactly that same complaint of reaching up, pulling on a piece of metal or a shelf, and feeling this pain in his arm and burning sensation and difficulties with the right elbow. Throughout all of the medical records that we submitted at the time of the initial claim and all of those medical records that the department has submitted, those right elbow and associated upper extremity complaints have been consistent. There is, on the next page, if you go to page U9, a reference to Mr. Eggert that he was moving rooms and his arm became worse after being involved in moving rooms. Couple of comments about that. First of all, if you go back to U8, Mr. Eggert is given a sling for the preservation and treatment of his elbow. He tells me that his arm was in the sling throughout that moving process and that he was required to move multiple times within a short number of days in his mind for unexplained reasons, and ended up using a number of other clients at MSOP, as well as one of the security guards, to help him move in order to get his materials from one room to another because he had the permanent or had his arm in a sling and the difficulty using his right arm. That series of events occurred roughly 2.5 or 3 weeks after the initial injury, and I don't think it'll come as too much of a surprise to anyone that being involved in some kind of physical labor immediately after that kind of injury might cause some temporary aggravation to that injury. If we then go on to the next page, which is marked U11 in the department's documentation, there is a reference again to Mr. Eggert being into the medical facility on July 20th and complaining of continuing complaints to his right elbow, and significantly the physician at that point found some tenderness over the lateral epicondyle, the elbow, and also some decreased range of motion in the shoulder with extension and internal rotation, and that the difficulties with the right upper extremity in the standard SOAP reporting, the assessment was persistent and worsening problems. And at that point, Mr. Eggert was given a tennis elbow splint in order to try to resolve his symptoms. To this point, he's not been referred outside, and he's not seen a medical doctor at that point of his treatment. The department, in their letter, makes a point about there's no claim of mistreatment or poor treatment. I think the records belie that statement in that it's not until some 13 or 14 months after this injury that Mr. Eggert is seen outside of MSOP and provided with treatment, initially a nerve conduction study, followed by a couple of visits to an orthopedic surgeon. The next page of significance, which is page 2 of U11, or side 2 of U11, is the August 5, 2010 visit where Mr. Eggert is given some specific exercises to follow up and continue with physical therapy. That's at the bottom of that page and is marked by a name I'm afraid I can't read, but it has RN after her name, so I presume that she's a registered nurse at MSOP. The next page, which is U13, is dated November 22, 2010. And here I think is an extremely significant record as we evaluate the course of Mr. Eggert's complaints. In his initial complaint, he talked about a disfigurement and enlargement in the right tricep and in the area of his elbow. And here you end up with a medical confirmation of that on November 22nd in the O column. There's a mild enlargement that the medical professional finds there. And in fact, at that point, the assessment is actually suspect SIG, which I presume to be significant elbow strain for Mr. Eggert. At that point, we're now some 6 months after the initial injury. Going on to the next page of the exhibit, which again is the reverse side of document U13, Mr. Eggert is advised by the physical therapist at that point that he is, and again I'm assuming that from the PT after the initials, at the end of that November 22nd, 2010 note, that Mr. Eggert is doing his stretching too hard and is doing too much range of motion and gripping work, and they need to back him off of his aggressive efforts to resolve his symptoms and get him to work less vigorously at accomplishing that. And so he follows that for another month and is seen back at physical therapy on December 20th of 2010. And again, the O column evaluation is essentially unchanged. So again, his symptoms are still there. His problems are still there. He's continuing on with the treatment program that the physical therapists have provided and in his efforts to accomplish some recovery from this injury. The January 24, 2011 note, which is on page U14, if you look at the little numbers in the upper right-hand corner, indicates that there is solid progress, although it is slow. Solid progress to the elbow, but slow progress to the, I presume, scapula. Again, it's S-C-A-P with a period after it, and my assumption is that that's a reference to his scapula, given that he's had shoulder problems since this incident as well, with some soft tissue injury and issues related to that. A month later, at the bottom of that page, he's again seen in physical therapy with a mild increase in trigger points and tension in the right scapula, and his right elbow is weak but improving. So again, we still have that same constellation of symptoms that Mr. Eggert is suffering from even as of February of 2011. We then get to Mr. Eggert is finally referred outside of MSOP, and he's seen by a neurologist for an EMG, a nerve conduction study, and the neurologist finds a denervation process going on in the right triceps muscle. And specifically, and perhaps most significantly in this process, is potentially due to focal trauma, which is precisely the kind of incident that Mr. Eggert described back in May of 2010 when he suffered the initial injury. He's then seen by the orthopedic surgeon in August of 2011, has some tenderness of palpation in the area, of his elbow still, and the doctor notes again some local damage to trauma that is found in the EMG examination that Mr. Eggert undergoes. The subsequent information, which I submitted to you in the letter, and I apologize for the typographical error in the math, in the letter is a series of additional medical requests that Mr. Eggert has sent into MSOP requesting continued care and treatment related to his right elbow and the problems that he's exhibiting related to it. The issue here, I think, from Mr. Eggert's perspective in terms of the medical care is that he received little or no care related to this injury. It seemed to be minimized by everyone within the facility for some 14 or 15 months until he was finally seen outside the facility and the discovery was made of the permanent injury related to the nerve and to the ongoing tenderness in his elbow and tricep muscle and the continuing difficulties in the shoulder. Mr. Eggert tells me that his physical therapist, MSOP physical therapist, has told him that he will never get better. And that the reason he'll never get better is because the treatment was so much delayed that there wasn't anything they could do by the time he got in there. The orthopedic surgeon says essentially the same thing. It's too late for us to do anything about this arm injury, and you're just going to have to live with it. The orthopedic surgeon told that to Mr. Eggert, and it's contained in both of his August notes that this is an ongoing problem. So contrary to the assertion of the department, I think we do have a delay in medical care and in the significant inability of Mr. Eggert to get the kind of medical care that might have resolved this problem on an early basis. And as a result, we in fact have a permanent injury. Now, the department also objects, obviously, to the wage loss claim that Mr. Eggert has asserted, and they provided us with their information related to his employment on a quarterly basis. First of all, I think it's interesting that it's quarterly. But second of all, if you track the time that he is missing work, it tracks almost perfectly with his medical treatment and the work that he's doing with the medical providers. There is a June 2nd, 2010 employment-related note from the vocational department folks that he's walking around and being unproductive and in unauthorized areas both on June 2nd and June 3rd. I don't know if the committee's been to MSOP. As you probably know, it's an extraordinarily secure facility. Mr. Eggert, along with all of the other patients there, are now under GPS monitoring as well as all of the other monitoring that goes on. And I think I can safely assure you, and Mr. Eggert assures me absolutely, that if he was in an unauthorized area, there would be more security bells and whistles going off and reports than one could possibly begin to count. There is no such record here. There's no security concern being raised with whatever Mr. Eggert is doing in terms of allegedly being in unauthorized areas. So I think that has a significant question about the validity of those claims. It's also interesting to note that in that July 3rd, 2010 report from Vocational Rehabilitation, he's doing fine in every category of work they bothered to evaluate, except for his work attitude. He's got a poor attitude. Why might he have a poor attitude being in a vocational setting of an industrial parts department where he's working on assembling items? He's there with his right arm in a sling. He's right hand dominant. So he's there with his dominant arm in a sling trying to do his work with his left arm only, or very minimal use of his right arm because of the limited use that he's been told to make of his right arm. I think that would impact all of our quality of work and our attitude towards work. And yet, there's no complaint or objection about the quality of his work. So he's apparently doing a good job, even with those limitations. Then there's, again, the July 9 reference to him being in an unauthorized area. It's not identified anywhere, and there's no security report related to it. And there's a reference in that July 9, 2010 report that he has been unproductive on numerous occasions. There's only one of the records that indicates that he's being unproductive. Of all of the records that they've submitted to the committee, I don't know how you get occasions from one occasion, and I would submit to you that if there were a lot of occasions of it, we would see more reports. There would be more evaluations from his supervisors. He tells me that he was working as hard and as fast as he could and that there were no objections by anyone to his productivity, the work that he was doing, the quality of his work, or in any other way related to the work he was engaged in until the June 11, 2010 incident. And what Mr. Eggert tells me is that at that point, the supervisor, the internal supervisor, the MSOP employee, was becoming increasingly agitated with him about his complaints of having to continue to work in that area and to his with his disability and to the pace at which he was working, which the more immediate, the folks that were supervising him on a daily basis didn't seem to have much trouble with, but that she was becoming increasingly agitated about it and in fact threatened to remove him from the vocational activity in its entirety because of those concerns. So in order to avoid that, he resigned because, as with most employers, if you get the black mark of getting fired, it's a whole lot worse than getting the black mark of resigning. And so he resigned as opposed to, instead of getting fired, he's still in a sling and is still undergoing the protective treatment that the MSOP recommended between then and the July 20 tennis elbow incident. The next several months, Mr. Eggert is not working much at all. It's when he's undergoing the most significant physical therapy and other treatment for that elbow as defined as prescribed by the department. He then gets a job in the laundry, and that's going well because it's a light-duty job or lighter-duty job. He can do it with one arm. He doesn't need to use his left or his right arm. He's been told by his physical therapist not to lift anything more than 10 pounds. 10 pounds is not much. Each of your claim books probably weighs more than 10 pounds. So I suspect that you can understand the limitations that he's under with a 10-pound restriction on his dominant side. He's able to work in the laundry and do the work that's required of him, and thus the payroll spike in 2011. On June 2nd, 2011, or thereabouts, the laundry job, he tells me, changed that he was asked to do, and he was then required to use both arms and to lift objects heavier than 10 pounds. He was now required to carry the laundry bags, the big laundry bags that are being brought into the laundry. And at that point, he could no longer physically do the work because of the limitations that had been prescribed by his physical therapist, and thus you see the payroll drop off for the following quarters. He's now working in the kitchen and finds that to be a lighter duty work and work that he is capable of doing at this stage within the 10-pound weight restriction. So I think if you do the math, even using the department's numbers, as counsel for the committee noted, he's got an average for the three quarters prior to the injury of $1,116. He lost $1,099, followed by $703, followed by $2,000. So there's $3,802 in total income loss as a result of this injury during the months when he was in between the lighter duty jobs that he was capable of doing related to or caused by the right elbow and upper extremity injury that he suffered. In addition, there are, I think, a number of factors that the committee should consider. I recognize the committee does not pay pain and suffering, but it does pay for permanent injuries. There is little question, I think, that Mr. Eggert has sustained a number of permanent injuries. He has the apparently undisputed deformity in his right arm as a result of this injury. He has the apparent, he has the medically found nerve injury, the denervation of his tricep, which no one is claiming does not exist. He has the ongoing neck and shoulder issues, which are apparently permanent from everything in the medical information that we have. He has the ongoing elbow issues, which are permanent from everything that we have in the record. And he has the issue with the healing process having been delayed and being very poor at this stage. All of this has the consequence to him of having his dominant right arm in a situation where it is much less useful than it was prior to this incident in May of 2010. He's got what appears to be a permanent 10-pound weightlifting restriction, some range of motion issues, and obviously the ongoing issues related to his shoulder and elbow and the inability to use either one of those to the full extent that he could prior to this incident. This has had a significant impact on his enjoyment of his and his activity level within MSOP. It's had a significant impact on his ability to handle his own self-cares. It's had a significant impact on his life in general. And thus, we believe that the committee should take all of that into consideration and award him the amount that we've requested or something significantly close to it.
Yes, we have other testifiers from DHS.
Any questions?
If there are questions from the members.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Timmons, why was he moving shelves?
I think, I don't know.
Was that part of his work assignment, or was he just moving shelves for the fun of it? Or was he building shelves
Mr. Chairman, or Representative Murphy, I think that would be a question that the Department of Human Services representatives would have to answer. I don't know the answer to your question.
So was he supposed to be moving shelves?
It could have been part of his placement. I don't know if it was
Please come to the table so we can get you on record there and identify yourself at the table and proceed with your answer.
Thank you, sir. Chad Mesogetic, Rehabilitation Supervisor. And to answer your question, I'm really not sure why he was moving the shelving unless one of his supervisors in the vocational shop told him that he needed to move from A to B or if it was items on a shelf. I'm not clear on that.
Representative, I may be able to help you. If you look at U1, the first document in the department's attachments, Eggert reported he was pulling on some shelving in the fulfillment area of the vocational shop and felt the sensation. And if you then go to the medical records, the first word on the May 18 entry is working. Lifted a piece of metal, felt a sharp pain in the elbow, and that's and that's further confirmed in the second entry of May 18. That's on page U9, lifting a heavy object in industry. Reports pain on a scale of 7 out of 10. And my understanding from talking to him is it was an assigned job. Just, Mr. Eggert is not a small person. He's worked out throughout his life. I have met him and talked to him in person, and I haven't talked to him in a number of years, but at the time that I met with him before, he was quite robust. Obviously worked out a lot and was well put together, not overweight by any stretch of the imagination.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Timmons, Mr. White, so he was there on assignment and doing what he was assigned to do.
That's my understanding from Mr. Eggert, yes, and the records.
And are these shelves like tin shelves or?
That I don't know. I didn't ask Mr. Eggert the specific weight. The records reference metal and or heavy object, so heavy metal object. So I can only surmise from those records.
Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. White, and maybe this is something later in its presentation for the department to answer to. I just flagged one thing as I was reading over this in the record. There's a, I don't know how to describe it in terms of page number. It's not in the U series, but there's a document here in any from MSOP, some clinical notes from some sort of clinician, and it's dated April 23rd, I think, or 25th, 2011. Tracy, I think it's C-E-G-L-A, is the person who responded. Tracy's sigla. It says vocation. And basically, Tracy says that it has been determined that if you have an arm injury and wish to tend to that injury, you will need to relinquish all vocational placements. It says temporary, I think she meant temporarily, until the arm is better. Until we hear from you, you will continue to work your assigned laundry tasks. So on the one hand here, it's saying stop working, which I would think would mean that he has that power to stop working. But then it says, until we hear from you, we will continue to work your assigned laundry tasks. I mean, the one sentence says, stop everything, no more vocational stuff. And then the next sentence says, by the way, unless we hear otherwise, you're going to work in the laundry. What do you make of that? How is that to be read? Is it that he ought to have refrained from working? Or is it someone else's responsibility that he apparently went back to work after that?
I think the answer is yes. again, in speaking with Mr. Eggert, he is not one who wants to avoid work or processing or continuing to engage in activity because the alternatives are not very pleasant at that particular facility. And so he will continue and has continued to work as much as he can within the physical limitations that he has. And I think I may have found, Representative, is the reference you're looking at, does it have a number 104 in the upper right-hand corner?
No, it has a 103 in the upper right-hand corner.
Okay, I now have what you're referencing, and it's an April 23, 2011,
right.
And then there's one April 27, 2011. These are both responses that Mr. Eggert receives from the health services folks when he sends in a client request form or a kite to ask about his physical condition and how he ought to be dealing with it. And the responses that he gets is, I think, and not too surprising with virtually any employer. If you can do the job, go do it. If you're physically incapable of doing the job, tell us that, and we'll take you off of it, and you can not be working. Mr. Eggert, again, in my conversations with him, has repeatedly told me that he does not want to be unemployed while he remains at MSOP. He wants to find work that he can do within his physical limitations. And it's only when he's assigned to tasks that exceed his physical limitations or put him at risk of further injury that he balks at it. And I think what you see in these May or in these April 2011 references are the written colloquy between him and his employer, if you will, about what he can and cannot do and what the consequences are of his making the decision that he's no longer capable of doing that particular job.
Okay. I'll be interested to hear the department's take on that.
I have a question.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about then when Mr. Eggert, he was starting to feel better, but he was moving his personal property into a new room on June 23rd of 10, and at that point he injured his arm?
Mr. Eggert denies that that occurred because it's his statement to me that his arm was in a sling and he was simply moving with his left arm, not his right. And so he doesn't know how he could have aggravated or increased the problem in his right arm at all. My assessment or trying to take that statement and the record and combine the two in some reasonable way is that he was moving and he aggravated that initial injury. Much as any of us would if we sprain an ankle and we start playing volleyball again faster than we should, which I'm exceedingly guilty of, as my teammates will tell you. And so you re-aggravate the injury and you re-aggravate the injury. I don't think there's anything in here that indicates that he suffered a significant new or different injury. And so everything in the record seems to relate back to that May 18 reference. And if I could, Mr. Chair, very briefly, Representative Simon, I think the answer to your question may be on the next page in what is marked 104 in the upper right-hand corner, where the response again from Tracy Segla, roughly a week later, May 2nd, Health Services did validate your restriction due to your injury. Therefore, your laundry hours have been filled temporarily. The restriction refrained you from all strenuous activity. Thus, all vocational programming needed to be removed until your arm is better. So I think what you see is the initial, you're asking me to do too much. Can we do something about it? And then the response, the ultimate response in 104, which is, we don't have anything for you. You can't work anymore until your arm is better. And to date, it's not better. He just continues to, fortunately, find some lighter duty occupations that he can do within the facility.
Any further questions? How about if we hear from the department? Please identify yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Leah Flagar. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Human Services.
I'm Carrie Anderson. I am a nurse practitioner at the Sex Offender Program.
Good evening. I'm Chad Mesogetic, Rehabilitation Supervisor at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in Moose Lake.
Mesogetic. Could you please spell your name?
Yes, sir. Mesoged, as in David, EC, Mesogetic.
Thank you.
Again, good evening. Addressing first one of the themes that ran through Mr. White's presentation here today was the quality of medical care provided to Mr. Eggert and by insinuation to the clients of MSOP. MSOP has an in-house health services department. It is staffed by licensed, well-educated, extremely experienced, and conscientious health professionals. I would personally feel comfortable going to them for my own medical care treatment, and I'm confident that they regularly provide high-quality medical care treatment to clients of MSOP. I'm equally confident that in this situation, they provided Mr. Eggert with that same high-quality medical care. I think you see that in the fact that within 15 minutes of Mr. Eggert complaining that he had strained his elbow, he was already seen by a health professional. As Ms. Anderson will testify here today, Mr. Eggert came back a lot for his elbow. He also came back a lot to health services for other complaints, some which were valid, some which may have been questionable. But each and every time that he went to health services, he was seen by those same competent health professionals and provided adequate, competent, high-quality care. Mr. Eggert, to the best of our knowledge, was moving shelves at the time that he strained his elbow. Within the 3 weeks after that elbow strain on May 18th of 2010, in his own words, he indicated that he was improving, that he was starting to feel better and better. That was despite the fact that he was not following the directions of his healthcare professionals in order to ameliorate his injury like we would do. It would be the physical therapy, making sure you're not moving it, so on and so forth. On January 23rd of 2010, Mr. Eggert, when he was not working in the vocational program, when he was moving his personal possessions, re-injured his arm. You can see that in the medical note from June 23rd of 2010, which was included in our materials, which clearly states that in Mr. Eggert's own words at that time, not multiple years later, when he's seeking financial remuneration, that he stated in his own words that he was getting better, no problems, and that he re-injured himself. When we're looking at Mr. Eggert's vocational history here, we provided quarterly earnings reports because that's how we keep our reports, and we thought that that would be most useful to the subcommittee. Obviously, if the subcommittee would like a more detailed breakdown of Mr. Eggert's earnings over that period, we are more than happy to provide that. So looking at his earnings and his vocational work, a couple weeks after his elbow strain, Mr. Eggert met with people in the vocational program and said that he was burnt out on the work he was doing. He no longer was interested in the type of work that he had been assigned, and so he didn't want to work there anymore. He voluntarily left his employment, not for, as Mr. White alleges and as Mr. Eggert claims, because of his elbow, but because he was burnt out. He didn't want to do the work anymore. Mr. Eggert then, for the next 6 months, elected not to work. In right around, I believe, in December of 2010, Mr. Eggert went back to work for 6 months without incident, no problem. He then again started to complain that his elbow was hurting him without revealing protected health information. I can also say that he had some other medical issues that might have been a concern to him during that time. But most notably, in November of 2011, Mr. Eggert went back to work. And he has been back to work for nearly a year and a half and is currently earning the same, if not more, than what he was earning pre-injury. And we're talking pre-May 18th injury at this point. As Mr. Mesogenic will testify here today, the vocational program is amazingly accommodating. They routinely accommodate clients with all sorts of physical limitations, some of which are much more extreme than even the ones that Mr. Eggert is claiming here today. And they will work with the client in order to make sure that if the client really does want to work, that they are able to work, provided they're still meeting their treatment obligations and that sort of thing. So if there are no questions based on what I've just said, what I'll do is I'll have Ms. Anderson testify a little bit here today. She is a nurse practitioner in MSOP Health Services and has a long history of working with Mr. Eggert.
Hello. As I said before, I'm Carrie Anderson. I've been a registered nurse since 1994, worked in large urban hospitals and rural healthcare settings from infancy all the way to geriatrics. I have worked at MSOP since 2007 as a nurse practitioner. I have been Mr. Eggert's primary care provider for the majority of that time. I did not see him for his initial injury. One of my partners saw him that day and, from what I can tell, appropriately said, you know, rest. She offered him a sling. He refused it. There have been many references to him working with a sling. To my knowledge, he was never issued a sling. I have reviewed his orders. He was never ordered a sling, so I do not know where those reports come from. I guess my firsthand knowledge started when I saw him for follow-up of this injury then. And when I saw him on June 9th, he, quote, said he was one-third better. He was avoiding use of his right arm. He had been provided a strap for his elbow. His pain was in his right elbow. That is where he had some tenderness. The lay term for it is tennis elbow. The primary treatment is anti-inflammatory medications, rest, and a counterforce strap. And as we've said, he was doing better. Then I saw him again 2 weeks later, and he was complaining that his arm hurt worse because he had to move and lift heavy items. Pain is worse than it was previously. And now at this time, he begins to complain of pain into his shoulder and his upper arm, where previously the pain was simply in his elbow. So he was given further recommendations for rest at that time to continue with the counter force strap. And somewhere along the lines, I'm not sure which date, I'd given him a handout on tennis elbow. And so when I saw him, he specifically asked if he could have the steroid injection that he read about in this paperwork. And I explained to him that that is for more resistant cases. At this point, you know, we were only 3 weeks into his recovery when he re-injured it. So basically you're starting over again with the 6 to 8 week recovery process. And so he's looking at an intervention that is saved for very resistant cases. And I can say with confidence about Mr. Eggert that he has real medical issues. There is no doubt about that. But one thing that is different about him when he comes to health services is that he believes that his problems are unique. If I told him he had tennis elbow, his is an extra special case of tennis elbow, and he requires specialty care and specialty services. And this goes along with his diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder. And we are very accustomed to working with people like this, and so we do take extra time to explain these things. We do take extra time to document very carefully what we've explained to him, and I explained to him that day. It was for that reason. Most of our primary care is provided by nurse practitioners at MSOP, and this is well within my capability of managing a case of tennis elbow, but it was for that reason of his ongoing complaints and his demand for special care that I did refer him to our medical doctor. And so she saw him and gave him some further handouts on shoulder injuries and stingers. I can answer any questions you have about those things specifically, but she referred him on to physical therapy, which he saw, and you can obviously read through the notes yourself, but over the course of these 18 months, we referred him to yet another doctor. We referred him out for an EMG study, despite the fact that we never saw any muscle atrophy, any limitations, that's shrinking of the muscle that would happen if you damaged it severely, any limitations in his range of motion. The only symptom we saw was some tenderness and some swelling after the initial complaint. But because of his continued complaints, we sent him out for these specialty tests. You hear about this permanent nerve damage. This is where his permanent nerve damage was. It was superficial, probably from some local trauma where you bumped your arm. clearly not where the initial injury was. He continued to complain despite seeing two physicians, a nurse practitioner, physical therapist. So we did send him out for an orthopedic surgeon. You can see by the physical therapist notes that his complaints just became so dramatic and didn't respond to the usual course of treatment that we really felt that there was nothing more we could offer. And so we sent him out to an orthopedic specialist, and he also said there was nothing that he could find to substantiate. His only complaint really is pain.
And we will clarify that the records from both MSOP as well as the two outside facilities that Mr. Eggert was referred to, Essentia Health and Mercy Hospital, are included in your documents that we submitted to you. If you read through the Essentia... Of course.
The council has...
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask a little bit more about the conclusions of the EMG test and the orthopedic specialist, if you could. Those are in your documentation. They're after the department's response, and they follow that U series. And then you'll see up at the top it says EMG. And I'm a lawyer, not a physician, and so I'm hopeful that you can help interpret conclusion number three there, which is the only one that discusses any abnormality, where it says there is evidence of very mild / minimal acute denervation process limited to right triceps muscle. Significance of this isolated finding is not clear because distal radial innervated muscles are normal and therefore do not meet EMG diagnostic criteria for radial neuropathy. Additional C6, C7 innervated muscles are also normal and therefore do not meet EMG diagnostic criteria for cervical radiolopathy, potentially due to focal trauma. Depending on evolution of symptoms, EMG study could be repeated if requested. Could you explain what, you know, how severe is this in terms of the finding and what does it mean?
What it means is that there is some superficial, this is your triceps muscle here, and there's some very mild area. You know, they take a needle and they put it in to find the nerves that are damaged, and they found a small area where it didn't conduct, okay, or it conducted more slowly. And the rest of the paragraph, they're explaining that none of the other nerves in the area or none of the nerves that are connected to that are involved. So that tells us it's a very small and superficial area, similar to, like I said, if someone had bumped their arm. Okay. Does that help you?
Yes. Okay. And now if I may ask another question, Mr. Chairman. Okay, now I'd like you to talk a little bit, look at the next page, which is the orthopedic visit, the visit with Dr. Gregerson. And again, really what I'm looking at is since the committee would pay for a permanent injury, I'm trying to make sure that we understand what there is in the record that would either support or negate a permanent injury. So that second paragraph on that where it says he has no redness or swelling, no skin lesions over the shoulder or elbow. He is full active and passive range of motion of the elbow and shoulder with no pain, snapping, popping, or crepitus on range of motion. He has a negative apprehension and impingement sign of the shoulder. I tried to Google those terms, but I'm not sure I understood what they meant. He has some tenderness to palpation over the lateral epicondyle of the elbow. His neurovascular status is normal of the upper extremity. This is in comparison to examination of a normal left upper extremity, which shows normal findings. Can you translate that into English for us?
What he is saying is that his exam of his shoulder and his upper arm were completely normal. That's testing the muscles, that's testing the nerves, that's testing the ligaments. The only abnormal thing that he found was some tenderness at your lateral epicondyle, which is the original tennis elbow that we're talking about. And similar to someone who sprained their ankle, when your body heals, it's never exactly the same, and so you may be more susceptible to spraining your ankle again. And I think that if he was overusing that arm or even simply performing his daily activities of that arm, he could have some tenderness at that point because of his previous injury. But that there's no nerve damage down the arm, there's no muscle damage down the arm. The only complaint is pain.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Pleitiger, did you have more to finish?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next, if time permits, we would like Mr. Mesogenic to testify here a little bit today. Mr. Mesogenic has a wealth of knowledge regarding the vocational program at MSOP and the opportunities offered to clients there.
Mr. Mesogenic, please identify yourself to the tape and continue with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Chad Mesogenic. I am still serving a capacity as a vocational counselor at MSOP. I've been employed there since 1996. On January 16th, I accepted a promotion to rehab supervisor position, where I currently supervise our vocational rehabilitation, education, and volunteer services department. Just being asked to speak a little bit about our vocational program. All of our clients are eligible for vocational programming. Client vocational programming hours are based on client phase, meaning if clients choose not to be engaged in sex offender-specific treatment, they're eligible for 8 programming hours per week. Clients in the Phase 1 piece of the program are eligible for 14 hours per week. Clients in Phase 2 are eligible for 24 weekly programming hours. I've known Mr. Eggert since he arrived at MSOP, I want to say, in Moose Lake since about 2009. Currently, he's in good health. He's an active participant in our industry vocational program. And basically, I'd just like to echo everything that Ms. Anderson said, that I have no doubt that he may have or he does have some other health-related issues. I just talked with him a couple weeks ago in our shop, and I think he was recovering from a flu illness or something along those lines. But he's working, and he's in good health as far as I know.
And Mr. Mesogenic, can you speak a little bit to the accommodations that MSOP offers to clients who are unable to, who have some sort of physical limitation?
Sure, absolutely. As Ms. Anderson could testify, we have several clients involved in our vocational programming with pretty significant medical issues. We have clients who are in wheelchairs with Parkinson's disease, working in our house or in our food service area, rolling plasticware. In Mr. Eggert's case, if someone were to come down with an arm-related injury, I might try to find a vocational placement in our library program. Or I believe laundry was mentioned. We have some light-duty placements within our laundry department. Really, it's all based on what a client is telling us. And we try to work towards accommodating whatever we can.
And MSOP records do show that Mr. Eggert never requested an accommodation at any point during those gaps in employment. Even if you take Mr. Eggert at his word that his concern was pain in his elbow, he could have been working. He just chose not to. Every year, each client goes through a health exam, annual exam, physical exam. And Mr. Eggers, it looks like, was most recently on March 25th of 2013. I apologize that we didn't get this to you before. According to this document, Mr. Eggers currently has no disabilities. Mr. Eggers is authorized to participate in strenuous physical activity, including recreational, leisure, and/or physical activity. In terms of any sort of restrictions that Mr. Eggert might have on his working ability at this point, client may work without restrictions is what is in his annual report here. Basically, what we have a situation here, members and Mr. Chairman, is someone who could be working, someone who is actively working now, earning at or above his previous earning levels. the gaps in his employment that he claims are due because of his elbow injury, if that pain truly was there and he felt that was a limitation in his ability to fulfill his vocational obligations, he could have requested an accommodation and he did not. Is there any other questions that we can answer at all?
Representative Simon.
Thank you. Could you repeat your name again? I'm sorry.
Sure. It's Leah Flygar.
Flygar. Okay.
Yes.
Ms. Flygar, you mentioned that last piece, which you acknowledged was not in our packet, the recent March health assessment. Do the clients have an opportunity to contest those? In other words, if there was an evaluation done of any client, I'm not talking about this particular individual, any client, could they say, do they have the opportunity, or do they with some frequency say, the person who evaluated me got it wrong? I either do have this condition or I don't have this condition. What is the general situation there?
Absolutely. They have the opportunity to do that at the time. Do I have to say my name every time
no,
I speak?
No, I'll just we talked to them. Yeah, I'll say your name.
So the answer is yes. And I think you have examples of client requests that they can submit. He can submit those at any time. When I see clients for any type of work-related injury, I ask them if they need a note for work. So they're offered that multiple times.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did have a question, too. You said that Mr. Eggert was robust and participates in recreational activities. Does he work out, or what does he do in his recreational activities, and does he wear his sling when he's doing recreational activities?
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Eggert does not have a sling. I just want to clarify that. I have encouraged him to be part of physical activity because of his other medical issues, and he chooses not to. He definitely needs to exercise and get some aerobic exercise for his other medical conditions that are going on. And he is not very active.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I think you would ask for a discussion amongst the committee members. And
Mr. Chair, can I comment very, very briefly? Sure.
Mr. White.
Thank you.
I appreciate the committee's indulgence. There are just a couple of things that I think are significant in what you just heard. Ms. Anderson indicated that the tenderness that the orthopedic surgeon found was not surprising to her, and she gave the example, I presume picking up on my own ankle injuries of the past, that when you injure your ankle, it's much more easily injured or susceptible to injury going forward, and that anything Mr. Eggert may have done may have triggered those symptoms that the orthopedic surgeon found when he was seen. That, to me, is a permanent injury. You've got an injury that doesn't heal. Your body doesn't heal perfectly. That's what she told us. And as a result of that, it is more susceptible to ongoing problems or injuries as you go forward. And I think that's kind of the standard definition of a permanent injury. So however you cut it, I think even the department agrees that Mr. Eggert has a permanent injury to that elbow as a result of what happened to him in the industrial accident. The second thing that I think was of some significance that the if you look at the kites, the information that Representative Simon questioned, again, that's information that Mr. Eggert is being asked, or where Mr. Eggert is asking for accommodations or changes to his employment. And the response, contrary to what we've heard today, was stop working. And so I think that the physical records, the written records of MSLP itself, indicate to us that, in fact, they're not as accommodating as they might be testifying here today before this committee, at least in terms of Mr. Eggert's situation. Finally, I have never seen this March 25th physical evaluation to the best of my knowledge. Mr. Eggert has never seen it. If he's never seen it, he cannot respond or question anything that's contained in it. So I'm at a bit of a loss to try to explain how he's supposed to challenge or question a report that or a document he's never seen. And I certainly, if I'd seen it prior to today, would have asked him a question about, this is what it said, do you know anything about that, and gotten his response, but I don't have that luxury.
Ms. Flagler.
And thank you for the time. I know that we're running short on it. Just to respond to those two points. First, the department respectfully disagrees with the statement that this is a permanent injury. We do not view this as a permanent injury. And as for the accommodation, the credibility of the department stands for what it is. We take our obligations to our clients extremely seriously. Mr. Mesogenic testified truthfully regarding MSOP's willingness to accommodate clients and absent proof otherwise. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question. Ms. Flagler, does the money that they earn go toward their keep?
Ms. Flagler.
Representative Murphy, Mr. Chairman, members, no. My understanding is that it is their own personal money that they can use to buy personal items, so on and so forth. It is their personal money.
Thank you.
Any information from the committee? Anything you're thinking? Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, do we just take a vote on
Senator Osmey. Yeah.
Just move on with
we
life?
We need to make a motion of, and the motion should contain a number, is that correct? Or a motion up or down?
It certainly would need to contain a number, Mr. Chairman, if the intent of the committee is to pay something to Mr. Eggert so that we can put it in the claims bill.
Senator Osmond.
Certainly don't want to be here all night. Motion to deny the claim.
Been a motion. I don't know that we need seconds, but yeah. Been a motion to deny the claim. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Claim is denied.
Let's do the quick one. The $3,700
Okay, we have a short one, which is the medical reimbursements for injury claims under $500 from the Department of Corrections. The number is, Ms. Counsel,
is that yes, Mr. Chairman, this is a standard matter for the Claims Committee that annually we reimburse the department for injury claims under $500, or I guess in this case there is one that's slightly over $500 that the department did already pay, and the requested total dollar amount for these is $3,701.60, and I believe Ms. Nicole Lind from the Department of Corrections is here to testify and answer any further questions.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption.
I'll second that. I assume you want seconds.
I don't think so.
It appears like we won't need any testimony. It's been moved to
you're very efficient.
To approve the $3,701.60 as the Department of Corrections claims. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion is passed. think we can go on to, we'll take the next, the claims against the Department of Corrections, injury claims. We'll take one that some people are here evidently from a distance, and that's the number three for Gary Green. Is someone here to speak to that claim?
Yes, I'll introduce the
claim. Counsel will introduce the claim.
Yes, this is the claim of Gary Green, and the claim is for $80,000. My understanding is that Mr. Green is represented by Counsel Jordan S. Kushner. And the claims committee members should also note that Health Partners did file a subrogation claim for $6,216.77 should the subcommittee decide to pay the claim. The claim is for permanent injury and wage loss stemming from an accident on March 24th of 2010 when Mr. Green was performing sentenced to service work in Hennepin County. And either his right hand or the pinky finger on his right hand was damaged, depending on how you read the evidence, was damaged between two boulders. But he was seen that night at HCMC for pain in the right small finger and side of his hand. Subsequently had carpal tunnel surgery on April 8th of 2010. But Dr. Tuttle, the surgeon, has indicated that she does not believe he has a permanent injury. Minnesota statute section 3.739 subdivision 2A does say private insurance is primary in a sentence to service situation, which is pointed out in the DOC response that Mr. Hartnett prepared. On the wage loss claim, the DOC says that Mr. Green was unemployed for 18 months before his incarceration in 2008. Mr. Kushner, I assume, will address that more in his testimony before the committee. I didn't see any documentation of particular wage loss or prior wage information from which any wage loss could be determined in the documentation. So with that, Mr. Chairman, perhaps Mr. Kushner could begin for Mr. Green.
Mr. Kushner, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jordan Kushner. I'm the attorney for Gary Green, and Gary Green is seated to my left. And I had some discussions with the Department of Corrections Council, and we would support their alternative recommendation, which would be to authorize payment for Mr. Green to have an occupational medicine evaluation. When I spoke to DOC Council, they were agreeable to that, so that's what we wanted to ask for today, because Mr. Green does need more of a medical opinion to document the extent of his injury. He did injure himself while doing sentenced to service for Hennepin County. It was should have been a non-eventful couple of days, but he ended up crushing a substantial part of his hand when the boulder fell on it, when he was trying to move boulders, which is probably not work that they should have been doing. He injured his pinky, but the nerve was damaged down to his through the bottom of his hand into his wrist, and so it's undisputed that he needed surgery for that injury. Dr. Sue Tuttle was a surgeon. To indicate that she was qualified to indicate whether Mr. Green was disabled, but referred him to occupational medicine for an evaluation. The problem is that Mr. Green's insurance, Health Partners, wouldn't cover an evaluation, and Mr. Green didn't have the money for an evaluation, and so that's why he's kind of been stuck throughout this time, because he doesn't have the funds to get this evaluation that's needed, which apparently would be about $1,200. I think his injury is significant enough so that it warrants a full full medical information to determine whether he had a permanent injury and an injury that would have interfered with him working. If it's not correct that he was unemployed for 18 months, he did work. Mr. Green had been working in mostly informal employment. He worked as a laborer in construction, you know, for contractors, and that's how he earned a living. And this is work that requires heavy labor, requires work with his hands, and exactly the kind of work that he's been unable to do in substantial part since this happened. And so upon the ability to get a medical opinion, then we would certainly work up, more, full explanation as best we can as to what work Mr. Green had been doing and the limitations on his income since then.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Kushner. I just want to make sure I understand what you're suggesting. I think what you're saying, if I understand correctly, is that you've reached at least a tentative or temporary deal, I suppose, where what you're requesting, I assume jointly, between the two parties, is you're requesting to go to the next step, which is to fund this evaluation at roughly $1,200, and the idea would be you're not surrendering the claim, but then based in part on the results of that evaluation, you would be back here at some later date. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Thank you for clarifying that.
Okay.
Other questions from the committee?
Is someone from the department here?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I believe we need to hear from Mr. Randy Hartnett from the DOC to make sure we understand what the parties have agreed to and are clear for purposes of the subcommittee's resolution.
Mr. Hartnett.
Should I move or?
Probably best.
Sure.
Stop this side. Mr. Hartnett, please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Randy Hartnett. I'm Associate General Counsel for the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and in that capacity, I advise Nicole Lynn, the claims officer. Mr. Kushner, first of all, I would like to, for the subcommittee, I would like to correct one thing that I think Ms. Timmons may have misspoke. I don't know what Mr. Green's employment history was prior to his working on the STS crew. The 18 months relates to another claimant that we have here today.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I can tell you that to this point we haven't received any documentation related to Mr. Green's purported wage loss, so I can't speak to that. As Ms. Timmons did point out, Mr. Kushner did send us a subrogation demand from Health Partners. That is a fairly typical response from a medical provider in a personal injury matter where we're not dealing with our statute here, 3.739, which says that any health insurance carried by the claimant is primary. So my recommendation is that that Health Partners, that part of it be denied because it's simply a subrogation from an obligation that Health Partners has under contract with Mr. Green. Mr. Kushner is correct. We did speak about this issue of his going to occupational medicine doctor. The surgeon, we typically like to get the opinion of the treating doctor, if at all possible, and to that end, I contacted Dr. Tuttle. Subcommittee has before it Dr. Tuttle's response, which is probably generously characterized as sketchy, although fairly unambiguous in that she does not believe that Mr. Green should have any ongoing permanent injury as a result of these nerve entrapment surgeries he had. But be that as it may, she also recommended that he have the occupational medicine appointment, and we take Mr. Kushner and Mr. Green at their word that the issue was payment. Now, what I would ask the subcommittee to do is to give us leave to provide payment for this occupational medicine appointment, assuming that it's in the neighborhood of $1,200. I would need to determine whether we were going to do that out of the funds that we normally use for the $500 or less claim that you've already worked passed on today, or whether I would need to get a contract for an independent medical examiner. And if that were the case, I would need to work with Mr. Kushner, because typically we would both want to have input into who the doctor is. At this point, my preference would be to work with Health Partners, because they're the folks who have Mr. Green's records.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hartnett, I've been on leave from this committee for a while, and so I don't remember. Why does it take so long? If this happened in 2010 and we're just dealing with it in 3 years later.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, in this particular case, the claim was, I believe, Mr. Kushner, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was probably submitted late in 2010. And then while we were collecting our information, the claim season came and went, and now we're into a new claim season. And that's one of the reasons that it took so long. In retrospect, if, in fact, at the time that Mr. Green was following his injury, he had some period of time in which he was receiving physical therapy to his hand. And had we done the claim at that point, it would have been too early, because he wouldn't have reached the point of maximum medical improvement.
Sure. And then, again, just for my informational purposes, Ms. Timmons said that Health Partners, somebody said, Health Partners didn't pay or wouldn't pay. Do we just, people that have insurance, we just allow them, the insurance people, to say, no, we're not going to pay?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it has been my experience that health care providers regularly deny paying for evaluations that are done for the purpose of making some sort of a legal determination. And I suspect that that's what the case is here. Mr. Kushner and I spoke about this last week. I haven't spoken with Health Partners, again, taking Mr. Green and Mr. Kushner at their word that it's approximately $1,200. That's certainly something that we would do prior to making that arrangement. To determine whether or not they, in fact, are going to require a payment, or whether that evaluation would be part of his insurance plan. I suspect the former, that they would ask someone to pay for it.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Hartnett, then, do you have any, the fact that you talk to Health Partners, does that make them feel like maybe they should pay at least for this particular evaluation?
Oh, the fact that I spoke with Health Partners?
Yeah.
I don't know, Representative Murphy. What happened was I initially sent a letter to Dr. Tuttle, who was the treating surgeon, and that was sent to her at the Hennepin County Medical Center where the treatment took place. And after the Hennepin County Medical Center sent me back my original letter because they didn't like the HIPAA authorization I had sent them, and asked Mr. Green to execute one that they had sent, then they sent me back another letter saying that Dr. Tuttle wasn't there anymore. So I went to the internet and found Dr. Tuttle and found that she was working at a Health Partners clinic, apparently no longer admitting patients to the Hennepin County Medical Center. It was at that point that I contacted her, sent the letter to her, and her physician's assistant actually responded to me via email, and that's that short email that I included with the materials.
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, it's hard to get in the way when when two parties are actually agreeing on a course of action. So I don't think we ought to do that. In terms of whether it falls under the 500 or less, I guess we do or should, for now, in my view, take the word of Mr. Kushner that it's about $1,200. So I'll make a motion, Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion that this committee recommend that the sum of $1,200 be added to, or up to $1,200. Let's say that the Department of Corrections is authorized to pay up to $1,200, which sum shall come from the claims, in the form of the claims bill, appropriation from the claims bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, what we have done in the past, in those cases where we have paid for medical exams, most often independent medical examinations, is we have submitted that with our with the claim related to that particular individual. In other words, our recommendation is that the subcommittee appropriate funds to pay for this permanent partial disability for these medical bills and for the medical evaluation. In this case, again, I need to find out whether or not the folks who are going to be paying the bill are going to be willing to pay that out of our current flow of medical treatment, because this is with a medical provider, a treating medical provider, or if I'm going to need to do a contract for a independent medical examiner. As I said, my preference is to work with the treating physicians.
Some clarification on the motion from
yes. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hartnett, I'm trying to understand, I think, if you need the committee to appropriate $1,200 now, or would you be able to take that out of DLC funds and pay, if necessary, for this exam, and then next year include it with the either with this claim or with the broader generic claim for reimbursement.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Ms. Timmons, at this point, I believe I can come up with the money one way or the other that I've already described it. Were we to ask the subcommittee to appropriate in this bill, that appropriation wouldn't be available to us until mid to late August.
Right. So, motion's been made to appropriate up or to request the Department of Corrections provide up to $1,200 to.
I think they're saying they're doing that on their own.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think you need a motion, but I think the motion would be to lay the matter over with the understanding that the Department of Corrections will seek a, what would we call this?
In this case, we're going to seek an occupational medical examination by his treating clinic rather than an independent medical exam.
Right, okay.
Mr. Simon, would you like to revise your motion to suit?
I'll try. So, well, I don't know that we need a motion to lay anything over, so maybe the chair can just, I don't know, Ms. Timmons, typically it's not.
We do normally reflect in the minutes that we've laid a matter over so that we have it in the minutes, I think.
Sure, so can lay it over like any other.
Pending thing. A report.
So would you like to withdraw your motion?
I'll withdraw my motion.
Okay. Motion's been withdrawn, and what we will do is we'll lay this over. We'll table this for future consideration. Okay.
Or not.
Okay, now we're back onto the agenda, and I believe our first injury claim is for Mr. Earl Brown.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Earl Brown is one that, because it is an injury claim, I recommended that we hear it but deny it. The claim is for $150,000. It does appear from the medical evidence that the back injuries claimed on October 24th, 2011 and November 9th of 2011 were a temporary exacerbation of a pre-existing degenerative condition that improved with treatment and just simply did not result in a permanent injury. The DLC does recommend denial on this one.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, unless there's anyone here representing the claimant here, I would, having read this information, I would move denial of the claim.
Motion to deny the claim. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. The motion passes. The claim is denied. Next one is Terrence Dumont.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Terrence Dumont is a claim for $200,000, and I see that this is the one that I mixed up in terms of the no record of employment for 18 months prior to incarceration. So it was immediately in the alphabet preceding Mr. Green, so I apologize again for that error. But in any event, on February 18th, 2010, while performing assigned duties at the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Stillwater, claimant was splitting wood, and he was hit in the head by a metal splitting wedge. The DOC is recommending a 2% permanent disability rating, which would be $1,500, due to ongoing headaches that Mr. Dumont is still suffering. The rating is complicated here because the claimant suffered a traumatic brain injury in the 1980s, which caused ongoing equilibrium problems and a speech impairment. But the headaches are new and thus, as I understand it, the basis for the DOC's recommendation of a small permanency rating. The DOC on this one does not recommend any wage loss because the claimant was not employed for 18 months prior to his incarceration.
Is there a testimony from the department?
Mr. Chair, to anticipate perhaps Representative Murphy's question, this one took a long time because Mr. Dumont disappeared for a while. But as sometimes happens with our folks, Mr. Dumont had a significant head injury in the 1980s. And the reason that I say it's significant is because the records indicate that he was in a coma for a week. That suggests to me that it was a very significant traumatic brain injury. We've talked a little bit about assigned duty. I would like to say in this case we are not contesting the fact that Mr. Dumont was doing assigned duty, but he was in our minimum program, and those guys aren't as regimented as our other offenders are, and he was apparently asked by by other minimum offenders if he would be willing to help cut wood for the sweat lodge. Mr. Dumont is a Native American. That was, it was something that they were doing as part of their cultural thing, I believe. But it was I don't believe they were assigned that by the staff, but on the other hand, the staff allowed them to do that and then ultimately reported it, reported his injury after they learned about it because they weren't being supervised by staff, but rather by another offender who was in charge of cutting wood for the sweat lodge. Mr. Dumont, after receiving this head injury, which involved a cut along this part of his neck, and if I have the wrong side, I apologize, I don't remember the pictures, and some stapling, started having headaches. And in the medical file, it's fairly apparent that those headaches continued to the point where he is still bothered by those. And in doing evaluation under the workers' compensation disability schedules, traumatic head injury resulting in persistent headaches is a 2% permanent partial disability. I suspect were Mr. Dumont here today, looking at him, you would say this gentleman's disability from his related to his head is worse than 2%. However, the significant head injury in his case happened prior to his going to prison, in my estimation.
Questions from the committee? Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion. I move that pursuant to the department's recommendation that we authorize $1,500 in the claims bill for this claim.
Motion's been made. of $1,500. This is a one-time amount. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Next case is Kent Jones.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Kent Jones is a case in which the department recommends paying $5,250 for the increase in back pain Mr. Jones suffered after doing some lifting at work at MCF Stillwater. In 2010, this subcommittee did hear a prior claim for wage loss and denied that, but the claim for permanent disability was reserved by the claimant. As I understand Mr. Hartnett's recommendation, it appears to be a fact that since lifting a bank of lockers onto a sawhorse on October 23rd of 2008, Mr. Jones has had constant back pain. He does have a history of chronic back pain, including 7 prior surgeries, but the DOC is recommending that the increase in pain warrants a 7% rating, which translates into $5,250.
Mr. Chair, pursuant to DOC recommendation, I make a motion to approve $5,250 for the 7% permanent disability as defined by the DOC.
Motion's been made to follow the department's recommendation of $5,250. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Next is Mr. John Lee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. John Lee is one that where the DOC recommended denial, and I'm in agreement with that. It's a claim for $3,000. It stems from an accident at work at the correctional facility at Stillwater on March 12th of 2012. And there's no dispute that claimant lacerated his right knuckle on a router blade, but he was seen immediately, and the medical records show that the injury healed up with no permanent injury. And I believe it's because of the lack of permanency that the department is recommending denial.
Discussion from the department?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. He was seen by the doctor all along related to treating the laceration. And the doctor on, it looks to me like it was on March 12th of, excuse me, that's not correct because that was the date of injury. My apologies to the subcommittee for that error. At some point thereafter, the doctor found his finger to be fully healed and fully functional. And because of that lack of any apparent permanent injury, we recommend denial.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
I would move denial of the claim 223474 for John Lee.
Motion.
Based upon the recommendations of the DOC.
Motion is made based upon recommendation of the DOC to deny the claim. Any questions from the committee? Seeing no questions, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Next is Mr.
I believe it's Ms.
Jody McCoy.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. Jody McCoy is a sentenced to service case in Washington County. And on February 29th of 2012, she did snow shoveling for 8 hours. And she claims that she began feeling pain the very next day, was seen on March 6th and treated for that pain initially. She then reported the injury the next two times, or one of the next two times she went to sentence and sentenced to service, either on March 7th or March 14th. Then on May 24th, 2012, she had surgery on her right hand, and although there is no evidence of permanency, so there's no DOC recommendation here to pay for a permanent injury, there is a recommendation to pay the medical providers $1,794.05 for her treatment, at the which would be at medical assistance rates.
What I'm seeing here is on the letter of March 4th, page 2, it says on 5/23, informed him that she had surgery. Is that needed surgery? And then looks like on the she had surgery on May 24th, so evidently that must just mean needed surgery. Any comments from Ms. Barber?
Mr. Chair, members, everything that Michelle Timmon said is true. She did. She did hurt her hand. She diagnosed it with intersection syndrome, and she did have surgery. The charges came to $6,297, and at medical assistance rates, it was $1,794. And we do recommend paying the MA rates to the providers.
Some discussion from the committee?
Chair, I'll make the motion.
Representative Johnson moves to pay the amount of the claim, $1,794.05. Any further discussion? Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. We have Margio Muck.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's Mary Jo.
Mary Jo. Mary Jo.
Yes.
Okay. Mary Jo.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, this is the claim of Mary Jo Muck, and this claim was initially heard on March 26th of 2012 by the claims subcommittee, but it was laid over to see if Ms. Muck's injury would improve. Instead, according to the documentation, the left rotator cuff pain has persisted. There's a fairly complex medical history, quite a complex medical history for this individual. Some of which is not perhaps directly relevant to this injury, but she did have left rotator cuff surgery in approximately 1993, according to medical histories that were taken. But then on October 12th of 2010, while she was on kitchen duty at Shakopee, she lifted a bucket of frozen apples and reported that she immediately felt a pop of pain, and not very long thereafter, on November 10th of 2010, she did have surgery to repair the left rotator cuff. And the DOC is recommending that the total rating here is 18.9%, but recommends attributing 50% of that rating to the pre-existing left rotator cuff injury and the other 50% to the work injury. So you divide 18.9% by 2 and get 9.5%, and that rating, as I understand it, translates into $8,505.
Comments from the department?
Mr. Chair, members, again, Ms. Timmons has accurately stated our case. When I brought this matter before the subcommittee last year, we had made a recommendation to consider rating her as she appeared at that time. She was continuing to have physical therapy at the prison, and did continue to have it. And as Ms. Timmons said, the subcommittee held the matter over. Unfortunately, it appears from the physical therapy notes that I received from the facility that even though she had ongoing physical therapy, her condition would get better, then get worse, get better, then get worse. I suspect, again, not being a physician, but I suspect that it was a combination of her prior injury, of her age, and the fact that she had a number of structural deficits in that area, which suggests to me that she may have had a weakness that, of course, doesn't take away our obligation to reimburse her for something that happened while she was at work. The pre-existing injury was a rotator cuff, and my apportionment is simply a Solomon kind of apportionment, which is there was one before, there's one now, we should divide it in half.
Mr. Chair, I move that we pay the claimant $8,505.
Representative Murphy makes a motion that we pay the DOC recommended claim of $8,505. Any discussion? I have to say that my left rotator agrees.
Okay.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign. The motion passes.
Mr. Chair, I have a rotator cuff issue too, and that's why I brought up the issue of age.
Okay, Dwayne Stevens.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. Dwayne Stevens is a case in which there's no question that Mr. Stevens did injure his right thumb on March 8th of 2012 while he was performing work as assigned for the correctional facility at Red Wing. And the DOC originally recommended denial on this one, but from the medical, we have sort of truncated medical records because they stop. They only go as far as Mr. Stevens was in custody. So, but based on those sort of mid-range post-injury records, it did seem to me that there was some evidence of loss of motion. And so I don't know what the department is thinking. We did talk about possibly laying over this one also to get some more medical information.
Mr. Chair, members, with this offender, he was injured while he was doing intensive community work service. So he was at a solid waste plant doing work, and so he injured his thumb and went back to the facility. Was seen by the doctor, was seen by the physical therapist. The physical therapist said that he should go back to almost maximum improvement. And so when Mr. Stevens got out of prison, he went to the doctor, and the doctor said, there's nothing more I can do for your finger. You need to go to physical therapy, which is what the physical therapist inside the facility said. Well, Mr. Stevens said that he can't go to physical therapy because it's 30 miles away. He can't drive because of DWI conviction, and he can't afford to pay for the physical therapist. And what he told me the last time I talked to him was that he was going to treatment, and he was going to see if there was a physical therapist there that could treat him. And basically what all our physical therapists said, one of our contracted employees said that there's no way that he shouldn't be at maximum medical improvement right now. So I'm not sure how he would like us to handle this, because basically what he told me is he can't go to physical therapy because he can't afford to get there, he can't drive. But our physical therapist said he should be fine by now, and even his doctor said there's nothing more we can do unless you go to physical therapy.
Representative Simon.
Well, I noticed that in Ms. Timmons' sort of memo to us, one of the options that she had recommended, which is the one that I find the most attractive, is is, well, first that she had apparently asked the DOC staff to be prepared with an appropriate rating and dollar figure. So I guess I would ask, is that accurate, and have you done that? Do you have a range?
We don't have a range because he's in treatment right now, so we haven't been able to contact him. We haven't been able to have him evaluated by a doctor. And I suppose he's going to say that he can't get there and he can't afford it. So if that's something that you would like us to do, again, we'd have to have leave to contact him and arrange what IME.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, what we have done in cases like this, and frequently our the folks who have been in our system have got the same problem that a lot of folks do, is that medical care is expensive. We are unfortunately not set up as an insurance company where we can pre-approve. We generally pay after the fact. Now, I have no idea whether Mr. Stevens is eligible for Minnesota Care or any of those things that would take care of his physical therapy. It sounds to me from what Ms. Lind had looked up that part of it was Mr. Stevens' motivation to get to medical care in addition to the cost. There isn't much we can do about that. I would be happy to make a suggestion on a rating for his thumb as it stood, but unfortunately we don't really have a basis for doing that on what we have, because it was our physical therapist's belief that he should have improved had he continued with physical therapy.
Representative Simon.
Well, I'd love my colleagues' thoughts on this. I'm not going to make a formal motion, but this is sort of the classic claims committee case where I think we just have to do rough justice here. My own view is that, unlike the other case where we had an agreement between the parties to go get an independent evaluation, I think we're going to just have to do our best here. And in connection with that, I noticed here when I went through this, his actual claim is not for the injury itself or for a permanent disability or injury. His claim is for lost wages. That's his formal official claim. It's not for the disability. He's saying that he's entitled to a payment because he missed work, not that he's entitled to a payment because he has a permanent partial disability. So I don't know if any great purpose would be served by going forward, and even if we did an independent medical examination. That said, my view is the guy was injured. The photographs are pretty gruesome, and I think we ought to give him some amount. His claim is for $10,000. I don't think he's substantiated that. But though I'm not making a motion, I'd be interested in my colleague's view about saying that we give him, and this is just the rough justice of this committee that happens sometimes, that we appropriate $1,000. I'd be interested in what folks have to say about that.
Representative Simon, I think I think that's reasonable. It appears like it was a compound fracture at the time. His bone stuck out of his thumb. But those kinds of fractures can heal to be normal again. So I think that's reasonable. That's my opinion. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, to Senator, Representative Simon.
See? Yeah, I know.
We're used to just being in senator mode. The problem I have with that is that we're sort of spitballing, and we're not actually seeing what he actually lost as far as wages, and if we start down this path, God knows what we can come up with. I mean, if he doesn't want to even provide us with some level of here's what I was doing and here's how much I lost because I wasn't working, then I'd have some basis to come up with some kind of a number. But without anything whatsoever, as much as the thumb is gruesome, I just don't see how I can justify it to the taxpayer, saying I have no way of knowing he was working at all during the period. So,
Ms. Timmons.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'd like to ask Mr. Hartnett. Okay, so this injury was on March 8th of 2012. Then and I realize there's the testimony that the physical therapist said he should have been fully recovered. if he'd gone to therapy. But the fact of the matter is that on June 1st of 12, the physical therapist said that the interphalangeal joint of the thumb had full flexion, but the thumb had active flexion to about 40 degrees and passive flexion to about 50 degrees, where 90 is apparently normal. So that was stated. And then after his release, while he didn't go to physical therapy, he apparently did see in his own doctor, somebody in, is it Bagley? Anyway, Dr. Esther Potty, and that was on August 20th of 12. And she didn't provide any ratings, but she did say at that time, so this is August, this is, you know, 5.5 months post-injury, she said that the claimant still had limited motion in his thumb and was unable to flex and extend the wrist well. And I don't know if based, if that information, if that's all the information you had, if you could suggest a permanency rating based on that for the benefit of the committee.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Timmons, unfortunately, without Chapter 5223 in front of me, which I unfortunately don't have, I wouldn't be able to. I can tell you that thumbs are worth more than the rest of the fingers. So,
okay. And Mr. Chair, to that point, we're talking about disability now, which I don't believe the claim is really going into. It's going back against, we're back again to loss of work. So, I mean, if the guy was a neurosurgeon and was working with his, needed his thumb, okay, now we can figure it out. If he was working at McDonald's, we don't know. So, with that, I would make a motion to deny the claim.
Yeah, we have a motion.
I didn't actually deny
it. You did not make a motion. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Hartnett, can you give a... he needs to go to therapy, right?
Correct.
If he had more therapy, he could get a little bit better. How much does it cost? How much would it cost to go to therapy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I don't know. I am going to guess a physical therapist versus a chiropractor, and I think a physical therapist is more appropriate here because we're not dealing with spinal injury. I would imagine we'd be... talking in terms of a thousand or two, depending on how many times they went there. Now, that's really a rough estimate, and that would be without the without using the medical assistance analysis on it. Another option that we have is, we've done this in the past where cases haven't had the facts developed, is we can deny but allow the claimant to request reopening once we have more information. And we could work with the claimant at that point. So if another possibility is, I would be happy if the subcommittee would leave the matter open and I could make a recommendation to Ms. Timmons after I've had a chance to review what we have here in light of the disability schedules. I'd be happy to do that as well.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I have to agree with Senator Osmek. Mr. Stevens done nothing to try to get his physical therapy. He had an opportunity while he was still in the prison to do this. Did not do that. I myself have work-related broken hand. Without the physical therapy, you will never get your full, it takes years to get the full mobility back without going through the physical therapy. Mr. Stevens done nothing to try to get the therapy. He hasn't provided any financial information of what his work was before this. So I'd have to agree with Senator Osmek to deny it.
Mr. Chair, members, Stevens...
never did get your name on the
record. I'm sorry. Nicole Lind, Department of Corrections.
What is it again?
Nicole Lind, Department of Corrections. When I spoke with Mr. Stevens, he was very adamant that he could not afford to drive the 30 miles to the physical therapist, and that was the closest one. So I'm not sure even if we said that he should go to the physical therapist and we would pay for it if he would even go, because he can't get there. He can't drive, and it's too far away, so I'm not quite sure. And when I did ask him for work information and statements and wage loss information, he's never provided that. And he just doesn't seem very concerned about his thumb compared to the money that he wants for his thumb.
Mr. Advice from the committee?
Mr. Chair, just one additional comment on page 2 where it says I would like to be paid for my days off. I think he may have the he can, if I'm not mistaken, he could reapply for the injury itself and for the occupational therapy at some point in time, could he not? He's just asking for the pay. He could file a second, a different claim for the physical injury.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I'm getting at the age, Senator, where I can't read your name tag from
Senator
here.
Senator Osmick.
Osmick, I'm sorry. Senator Osmick, yes, he can. Actually, it's my understanding, and Ms. Timmons could disagree with me if this is the case, that he could ask for leave of the subcommittee to reconsider even the wage loss claim.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I believe what the rules say is that typically a claim would not be reconsidered by the subcommittee unless the claimant presents newly discovered evidence. Well, it does say that by due diligence could not have been discovered in time for earlier hearing, but we have periodically, when claimants have submitted additional evidence, then, you know, usually I've discussed it with the chair, and if it seems reasonable, we've brought it back to the subcommittee.
So if he submits a claim on and, actual cost
and
himself.
Actually had some wage loss and perhaps further evidence of a permanent injury.
Senator Murphy, Representative
Senator Osmick, would you amend your motion to with pending additional information?
I was actually in the process of coming up with the language in my head. So, Mr. Chair, I would revise my motion to with a motion to deny with the opportunity for the applicant to return and take leave if additional information, if this case is available regarding wages and or disability.
Would that be a motion to deny loss of wages claim, or would we just not touch that?
I think maybe we just deny the claim, period.
Okay, deny
the claim. And then I think what the staff can do is in the denial letter make it clear the committee's intent that we've denied his claim, but he could come back if he has additional information on the wage loss or the permanent disability.
Senator Osmond moves that we deny the claim with the potential of refiling with new information. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Motion passes.
Excuse me. In the letter, I think it should say something about physical therapy.
Next is Keith Washington.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, this is the last of the injury claims for this evening. And this is one where the DOC recommends denial. The claim is for $7,000 for an alleged injury to Mr. Washington's back because on December 30th of 2011, he claims he hurt his back when he was carrying bins of property at the correctional facility at Oak Park Heights. He was seen that day and several other times, prescribed pain meds, steroids, muscle relaxants. And then by the middle of 2012, the medical records show that his range of motion was normal, so there's insufficient evidence of a permanent injury. And I believe that's the rationale for the department's recommendation to deny.
Department comments?
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct. We do recommend denial because there is no evidence of a permanent disability.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
I would move denial of the claim for Keith Washington based upon the recommendation of the DOC.
Senator Scalzi moves denial of the claim in concert with the recommendation from the department. Any further discussion? Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Next, we have property claims, and the intent is to take. Do we have any that we want to pull out? Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Let's nominate some to take out.
Perhaps I could just explain the process a little bit, with which Representative Simon knows that typically what we do is if there are claims that either I as the council wish to pull out and discuss individually, or any of the subcommittee members wish to pull out and discuss individually, we'll do that, and then we usually do a blanket denial for the remainder of the claims without going through them one by one and talking about the facts.
Oh, come on, let's be here all night.
A discussion on that? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple that I flag that I thought were significant. Before I do that, I just want to say, you know, this is the third time on this committee. And while on the merits, I do find that almost all of these claims I would vote to deny, I just feel the need to say on the record, I think that very often the deck here is stacked against these folks making the claim in the sense that first of all, they're not here because almost all of them are in custody or in a facility. Second of all, though the conclusion, based on the record we have, is correct in my view almost always, that there is insufficient evidence of negligence on the part of someone from DOC, it sometimes occurs to me that I'm not sure how that offender would ever prove negligence, short of some sort of camera or recording. And so my gut feeling is, having been on this committee before, that there's some percentage of the time when they're right, but they just can't prove it. They write something on a kite form and they say, this was here one day and it wasn't. There's no tape. There's no witness. And so we're forced on the record before us to say, and I think we rightly conclude in those instances, that that there is no evidence of negligence. I'm not offering a solution, so perhaps I'm not being constructive, but I just sort of feel the need to say that. I'm not singling out any particular claim, but we're putting these folks in a bind. Some of them may just outright be lying. I concede that, too. Maybe they just want an extra pair of shoes or something they lost. But I just have the sense that some percentage of these are true claims. But it's very difficult to prove. That said, Mr. Chair, the first one, at least, that I pulled out was the one that's numbered on your numbered list here, number 35. It's Mr. McCoy, Arthur McCoy. This is one where it just was a timeline issue for me. I'm reading from Ms. Timms' just very brief assessment, two or three sentences on the last page, where she says, claimant says that two pairs of Nike tennis shoes disappeared when he went to segregation on 6/5/12. The inventory on 6/8/12 does not show the presence of any tennis shoes. I read that, and of course read the documents here, and my first question was, you know, why did it take 3 days to inventory his stuff? After all, he went to segregation on the 5th. So while it's true that on the 8th, when they inventoried his items, there were no shoes there, I don't know that that necessarily proves that it wasn't negligence. I guess it doesn't prove that there was either. The point is, somebody waited 3 days to inventory his stuff. There were no shoes there. The department's position is there were no shoes there when they inventoried his stuff, so he never had any shoes and they weren't stolen. I guess one fair reading of that would be there was a 3-day period between when he went to segregation and his shoes were sitting there. You know, again, this is one of those cases where I don't know how this particular offender would ever really prove this in sort of a legal sense, but I thought we should at least discuss it. And this is kind of a primary example of where, unless I'm misreading the timeline, there was a 3-day gap, and that alone, while not pure negligence, is... I know folks are busy and they probably have other things to do, but for 3 days his stuff was sitting there. So I'm just not so sure that it's clear that because they didn't show up 3 days later, that means that he's not telling the truth.
Mr. Chair, members. When offenders are in their cell or they leave their cell, they're responsible to lock up all of their items in their property bins. And so when he went to psych, he did have a pair of tennis shoes on, but when he left his cell, he should have locked up his shoes. And if he was taking a psych from his cell, which I don't have the list of where he was when he went to segregation, he was wearing a pair of shoes, and you're correct, there might have been a three-day leg, but staff can't always get to that cell right away. So if he didn't have a cellmate, the cell would have been red taped or red boarded and the stuff pushed back from the bar so that other offenders couldn't take it. And if he did have a cellmate, then he could have locked up his items. I did try to contact Arthur McCoy, but he was AWOL, so I couldn't get any more information from him. So even if we do decide to pay this claim, I'm not going to know where to send the check to.
Mr. Chair, members, another thing that, and I can't say that this is for certain, but there are cases where there is a cell pack-up. In other words, the items are taken, if there's a two cellmate situation, the items from one cell side of the cell are taken, packed up, and then taken to the property room, and then inventoried in the property room at a later time. So you're correct. There is a period of time when those things are not being inventoried, but very typically either by red paneling or by taking the material away from the cell, at least from the standpoint of we're hopefully protecting that property from the cellmate or from other offenders who have been known to walk past barred cells and reach in and take things.
Mr. Chair? Okay.
Senator Scalzo.
I just have a brief question. If they're responsible for locking their bin and then they go to segregation and they still have that key with them, so how could someone reach in and take them if they're in a
no,
lock?
I
misunderstood, maybe.
Senator, what I have personally seen videotapes of people reaching into cells. Mm-hmm. So what the staff do is they push the stuff back, and when they say red panelers, they take a piece of red plywood and cover the front of the cell with it if it's a single cell situation so that offenders can't reach into there. We're all very cognizant of the fact that a number of the folks we have in there may have a reputation for dishonesty. There are any number of things that can happen, and Representative Simon, I don't want to discount your statement because I think that there is some validity to it, but we also have offenders who give their stuff away. We have offenders who, oh, he just got taken to SAG, I'm diving in there to get his stuff. Or we have... So it's any number of things.